The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Cardiomyopathies is presented by Dr. Martin Burke.
Thanks and good morning. My pleasure to be here. I like this lecture. I know it seems like an extremely broad topic, but this is a topic that ties into just about everything that you're going to learn in the cardiology section for the board review. And so this is more of an informational type lecture to give you nomenclature and a few tidbits on where this might be applied into the questions within the board test. And so just to get you back on board, and actually within the syllabus, there should be all these pictures that you can quickly review and look at, and I try to keep it very organized for you. So it's a quick review that you go into before you take the test. I do a lot of different research protocols, but there's no real disclosures on this particular lecture. All right, so just to be on the front end of this, and this shouldn't be news to anybody because these are generally old nomenclature disease definitions, but essentially the most recent is disease of the myocardium associated with cardiac dysfunction, so that's pretty broad. So even in the previous lecture that Bob gave, you have a number of the arrhythmic diseases that are technically what we call arrhythmic cardiomyopathies. And there's even newer ones that are probably out there that haven't been defined yet. And those are typically inherited, and they can be somewhat related, such as a correlate to right ventricular cardiomyopathy, which causes a lot of arrhythmias. So essentially, when you see somebody initially with a cardiomyopathy, it's usually their first presentation is pulmonary edema or some correlate of congestive heart failure, which I'll be talking about later today. This is just a full airspace consolidation that you might see with either a respiratory condition or with profound heart failure. And obviously, an echo would be the first test that you would get to confirm that. I do want to bring up that there's a lot of work being done right now around the cardiomyopathy of conduction disease. And so, and this is just a correlate to tachycardia-mediated cardiomyopathy, where there's some physiologic stress to the heart, which leads to a dilation of the heart. Consequent to conduction disease, it's either tachycardic and or bradycardic. In this case, classic IVCD would then lead to the development of a cardiomyopathy, and this can be reversed with not just medical management, but with pacing to resynchronize the heart. This is an example of the natural history of most of the patients that you see in your clinics that are with an ischemic cardiomyopathy. And an ischemic cardiomyopathy is oftentimes not to the low ejection fraction status, but the majority of the patients who have this die suddenly, and this is their first event. This patient technically was in a safe area because she was in the ER with chest pain when she came in, and what you're seeing there is the classic early after depolarizations that occur in a long QT status. Now, this is an acquired long QT status due to ischemia, and there was, if you looked at the full report behind this event I show because it's dramatic, but before that you saw this intermittent heart block that was going on consequent to a near totally occluded circumflex artery. Then you get the PVC on the T wave and you go into ventricular fibrillation. So it's very rare that we get a bird's eye view of this particular type of cardiomyopathy. This is the most common cardiomyopathy in the developed world. And this is what happens and why patients actually don't survive their first insult of either massive ischemia and or acute coronary syndrome. So if you look at the heart failure mortality, there is a natural history as you move through the cardiomyopathy. And so in these first presentations and understanding that getting on to the diagnosis of a cardiomyopathy can have a very profound impact on the patient's survival, their medical management, what kind of therapies you deliver to them, such as a defibrillator that Bob talked about in the previous lecture. But if you look at this, the sudden cardiac death rate is much higher earlier in the cardiomyopathic process. The progression can be very quick or it can be very slow and deliberate, and that depends on the type of myopathy that you're talking about. So how do we classify these? They're dilated, hypertrophic, restrictive, arrhythmogenic, and unclassified. And some of the unclassifieds are just inherited conditions of the heart. And when you look at fibroelastosis and LV non-compaction, in non-compaction, you can think of it as a cauliflowering out of the left ventricular endocardium. So instead of it having a smooth, even if it's trabeculated, it can be very smooth. This is where you don't have that smooth endocardial layer, and it looks like a cauliflower on the apex on an echocardiogram. So let's go to the most common that I mentioned. It's ischemic. You can see that what happens in ischemic cardiomyopathy is you develop a scar that's transmural. You can see that this causes a segmental or regional wall motion abnormality and or dysfunction. You can see what happens to the remaining myocardium on the other side of the scar where it picks up to try to compensate for the scar. And it's within the scar and along the edges of the scar that you develop the substrate for ventricular tachyarrhythmia. And as you see, if you don't do a lot to take some of the burden off the left ventricle, you're going to have worsening dilation of the remaining segments that are actually not infarcted. If you look at specific etiologies for cardiomyopathy beyond the ischemic, valvular and hypertensive should not be left off the process. And then in the evaluation of inflammatory and infection, cardiac MRI is the gold standard now to assess for microfibrotic regions and or infiltrative regions in such diseases as Chagas and or HIV. Metabolic and inherited cardiomyopathies are not uncommon. Inherited would be the second most common, and this would be in the realm of dilated cardiomyopathies, which we'll talk about in a second. And then more common these days, and something you have to take into account, is the burgeoning post-chemo cardiomyopathies that we're seeing in survivors of cancer. And these are survivors as far out as 20 years. And so a lot of work is being done to try to see how we can prevent that type of chemotoxic-related cardiomyopathy. And specifically, it's directed around giving patients beta blockers very early on before they have any symptoms of cardiomyopathy and or development of myopathic disease. Peripartum is much less common now and is probably a correlate to inherited dilated cardiomyopathy, but we'll talk about some of the natural history of peripartum in the next few slides. And then don't forget about Takotsubo. It's a classic board question. And Takotsubo really is a condition that is motionally related. And on the echo, it's a blowing out of the left ventricular apex. And Takotsubo is Japanese for octopus head. And so what it looks like is the head of an octopus. And so it's very classic to try to trip you up on Takotsubo versus an anterior wall myocardial infarction. But the key here is that the patient's presentation on EKG and the circumstances in which the patient came in. It's usually an elderly patient who takes a fall, can't get up, has rhabdomyolysis, and the stress of all that has led to this temporary cardiomyopathy. And it usually resolves with supportive care. But they can come in with a fair amount of heart failure at that time, and they're obviously in great extremis. Okay, so this slide is actually, I think, something that you should review before you go into the boards, because it looks like a really good matching question. Might just say that. So if you look at this, the histopathology of these conditions can be extremely helpful in understanding the differential, but also to get to a final diagnosis so you apply the right treatment. Amyloid, ARVC, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, inherited hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And you can see that there's differences in the histopathology. And what we're doing now from a clinical diagnostic standpoint is using cardiac MRI to help distinguish all of these diseases. And so when you look at hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, the treatment for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, whether it's sports-related, hypertensive-related, congenitally related, will have a lot to do with the burden of scar on an MRI. And just like you can suggest a burden on a nuclear test, you can actually, on an MRI, designate a percentage of left ventricular scar burden. And this is very helpful to manage patients. So dilated, the majority of cases are idiopathic. The incidence of idiopathic dilated is 5 in 8 per 100,000 people. It's likely higher due to mild and asymptomatic cases and 3 times more prevalent among males and African Americans. And this is due to the genetic predisposition. They can be both autosomal dominant and recessive. Mostly autosomal dominant are beta-myosin etiology, and that would be a very good answer to a question. So beta-myosin-related dilated cardiomyopathy is most common. Has a high mortality rate, and it's autosomal dominant, so it's going to be prevalent within a family. Essentially, this is the slide that you would look at in a cross-section that differentiates from an ischemic. So they might have a matching with ischemic cardiomyopathy with the full bore scar in the other region that's picking up the slack, whereas in dilated cardiomyopathy, it's generalized, and the hypokinesis is throughout the entire ventricle. As I mentioned, the inheritance patterns already, associated phenotypes are skeletal muscle abnormalities such as Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, Becker's muscular dystrophy. There's neurologic and auditory problems that can be associated. You can see abnormalities in energy production, contractile force generation, and then, as I mentioned already, the myosin actin and dystrophin are the most common entities of the myocardial structure that are affected. Infectious is the next related. HIV is not as common anymore because it's obviously treated much better. This was a historical feature. It was usually associated with encephalitis. So if the patient had encephalitis with HIV, which is luckily not as common anymore, but obviously you may see this, the right board question. The patient might present with and encephalitis related, have HIV positivity, and then they might ask a question about what you would do next. And obviously you'd want to do an echo and or a Holter monitor to see if they have any arrhythmias, because a lot of times they present with PVCs and non-sustained VT with HIV-direct cardiomyopathic infiltration. It's more segmental type of scarring, like a granulomatous disease, and it can be obviously confused with sarcoidosis, so be careful. Remember, sarcoidosis is the great mimicker, so it can be just about anything, and so all these infiltrative type cardiomyopathies can be very confusing. It's up to you to distinguish between infectious, and they might give you some details in the case report during the test, and then that leads to your answer. So some of these other ones are not as common in the United States. Chagas, Lyme obviously is, but it takes a lot, and people are treated much quicker today. with Lyme, but Lyme disease is really, and Chagas are treponemal in nature, and so they're very similar to a syphilitic type of problem, so they get aortic diseases. In this case, they get high degree AV block with Lyme disease. Chagas is usually an epicardial type of infiltration of treponine and seen from South America. So travel history is an important thing, and if they're down in South America, consider Chagas disease as a cause for their cardiomyopathy and or arrhythmic disease when they present. Mechanism of cardiomyopathy here is myocyte cell death, infiltration, immune-mediated injury, and it's no change with immunosuppressive drugs. Obviously, that's probably the negative there. So when you look at dilated cardiomyopathy, this is the second most common cardiomyopathy. So the first is ischemic, but you can have this from all kinds of chemo and or toxic relation. Alcoholic cardiomyopathy is probably of the toxics most common. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is, in this state, concentric. And what you see here is sort of this, you know, classical almost total obliteration of left ventricular chamber size, and this would be more consistent with a hypertensive type cardiomyopathy or a familial cardiomyopathy that can either phenotype as this or dilated or a combination of both. So you have to consider genetic testing there. There's not a lot of fibrosis in this postmortem. In this, you can see the difference. There is some fibrosis that infiltrates. It's not in broad band like an ischemic model, but it's very punctate and diffuse and microfibrotic in nature. And just to look at some of the guidelines, mostly that would be ripe for the test in this time frame because they were from 2011. They should make them into this. This is a real quick review that you can look at right before you go into the test to give you an understanding with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, where you're looking at genetic mutations. There's sarcomeric, and then there's non-extracardiac and or metabolic findings, and genetic substrate is unresolved. That would be the majority at this state, but actually genetic testing becoming much more prominent is leading to a status where you can actually have better diagnosis, which will give you a better understanding for prognosis and may give you a direction on treatment plan. Furthermore, if you look at the patients who have the metabolic findings, its findings are associated with or without mutant gene. The syndrome is consistent with also carrying it's not, so what this means is that the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is a subsegment to the metabolic disease, and it's not a direct mutation within the myocardial structure. So if you look at prognosis for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and targeted therapy, you can see, obviously, you worry about sudden death, progression to heart failure, which leads to end stage. To be honest with you, most hypertrophic cardiomyopathy patients suffer with atrial fibrillation because they lose their atrial kick, which they need to actually perfuse and move blood through the myocardium that's already stiff. And so whatever you can do to be aggressive about the atrial fibrillation. Sudden death is usually affiliated with cardiomyopathy that has a lot of scar in it because you have normal tissue next to abnormal tissue, and that sets up for reentry. And so when you look at that, consider an MRI in your hypertrophic cardiomyopathies to help phenotypically understand better where they fall within the spectrum. Heart failure is much later, and if you have segmental hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or, say, a non-compaction type syndrome where you have heavier tissue next to thinner walls, that can lead to myocardial rupture. And so you get end-stage sudden death as that's non-arrhythmic in nature. Looking at restrictive cardiomyopathies, amyloid is on the forefront. There'll probably be testing on amyloids related to the treatment for this because now there's a treatment for early age TTR type amyloid. And so they're doing a lot with antibody treatment for this. And so they're gonna want to make sure that you are thinking about this whenever you see patients with atrial fibrillation and myocardial PVCs. That can also be sarcoidosis, so keep that in mind. You can see the nature of the non-infiltrative disorders that I've talked about a little bit. Scleroderma can affect the heart. I want to point that out. And then pseudoxanthoma elasticum. It's very important to look at the more rare things for your tests because those are the things that they usually try to trip you up on within the differential diagnosis. Infiltrative disorders that are most commonly tested on are amyloidosis and sarcoidosis, and less commonly Gaucher's disease and Hurler syndrome, but you can see where those might help because they'll give you, of the syndromes, they'll give you other components that are part of it, and always consider it in the test question if there's a cardiomyopathic feature to it and the other signs and symptoms. Fatty infiltration is predominant across the right ventricle in most common, but it can be within the left ventricle, and so it's a little bit of a misnomer, and the nomenclature hasn't changed from right ventricular arrhythmic cardiomyopathy. It's now just right ventricular cardiomyopathy, but it can affect the left ventricle, so don't be surprised if you see fatty infiltration in the left ventricle that it's not the same cardiomyopathic genetic problem. And then endomyocardial fibrosis, hypereosinophilic syndromes, Loeffler syndrome, carcinoid disease, metastatic cancer that is typically affiliated with the renal cell carcinoma that gets to the right ventricle, exposure to radiation, toxins, anthracycline, most commonly doxorubicin, is the one that you'll see as a chemo-related endomyocardial problem. Serotonin should not be in the heart. Somebody asked me yesterday during the cardiology section if you can find serotonin-related receptors in the heart. You can, but they're not supposed to be there, and so it's abnormality and will cause a cardiomyopathy. Mercurial agents, you won't probably be tested on, but this is something that's related to, say, treatment of leishmaniasis. So somebody coming up from South America might have some of these problems with toxic, and it's usually related to LVH. It looks on the EKG like LVH, and then they have bradycardias, high degree AV block, and sinus bradycardia due to these drugs. Sarcoidosis is always on the test, and you need to understand sarcoidosis. It's a biopsy-proven disease. It can be surmised when patients have three things part of the syndrome. So they would have an external biopsy, maybe of a node that's in the chest. They might have pulmonary sarcoidosis most commonly, but they can also have skin mark-related sarcoidosis. And then if you see a patient with atrial arrhythmias, ventricular arrhythmias, and mitral regurgitation, you got to consider that a classic sign and symptom of sarcoidosis. So they already have some disease diagnosed sarcoidosis, but then they have those three things within the heart. Consider sarcoidosis as the cause for that. Most of the time, you're not going to get a biopsy within the heart. You're going to get an MRI and see if they have infiltrative type fibrosis or granulomas in the heart. A lot of times they present with just the arrhythmias and sudden cardiac death. The most sensitive test for diagnosing sarcoidosis in somebody that has other manifestations is the EKG. And then the second, after you do that, then you can do an MRI. Endomyocardial fibrosis is endemic to many parts outside of the United States, so be familiar with these because obviously people traveling from those regions to the United States would be a prime test question. And then hypereosinophilic syndrome with Loeffler's endocarditis, which is demonstrated with just a right ventricular disease process, and it's highly fatal. And you know, it's very difficult to treat. What you see here in this endomyocardial fibrotic picture is this mismatch between thicker areas of the ventricle, mostly endocardial, and then you see thinner areas next to it. And so this is actually quite easy to diagnose with echocardiography. RV dysplasia, you can see in this MRI that the right ventricle is in the left, and the left ventricle if you look at the screen, is on the right. And what you're seeing here is a blown out aneurysmal type right ventricle on the MRI, thin walls, and then you see in the left side at about 9 o'clock there, you see that full thickness brightness within the MRI. And that's fatty infiltration. LV non-compaction obviously be a great test question because it has such differentiating features. The standard test to diagnose this is echocardiography. You can also get an MRI if you have some difficulty with the echo, but it should be very prominent on the echo that there's that lack of smoothness across the apex of the heart, and it's typically thicker and cauliflower-like along the endocardium. Not too different, you know, the differential with that is the endomyocardial fibrosis. But in this particular thing, you see thin, compact epicardium and thickened endocardium. And prognosis and treatment is increased risk of CHF, VT, sudden cardiac death, and obviously thrombosis is another feature because of the trabeculations and the lack of function of the myocardial tissue there. There is a hereditary risk, so screening of offspring is important. And that's the picture of LV non-compaction. So you see the thinner parts on the epicardium. You see the very thick part in the apex there, especially on the highlighted echo on the right. And you can see that the chamber size is somewhat dilated outside of that thicker part in the apex. And it's usually along the lateral wall that you see a lot of the trabeculated non-compaction. To follow up, peripartum cardiomyopathy, the prognosis is actually much better than any other cardiomyopathy that patients present with. So I'll show you the final slide in a second. But you can see that obviously it's an increased risk with maternal age. The differential here is an inherited dilated cardiomyopathy, and you can get a lot out of the family history here. So if you take a very in-depth family history in patients with cardiomyopathy, you can usually get a lot of direction as to where you should go with the workup. More importantly, with the risk of recurrent pregnancy, and these are very small numbers in retrospective, the reduced ejection fraction and heart failure in 44%. There can be a lot of recovery in these patients with very aggressive management that we've not seen in the most recent evaluation of peripartum cardiomyopathy. And so, you know, I'm saying, you know, with the advent of Entresto and you know, better intensive treatment with ACE inhibitors and beta blockers, you can do a very good job of reducing the cardiomyopathy and regain normal left ventricular function. One thing that you can look at is the contractile reserve is reduced in patients with that do not or are likely not to recover postpartum. In that case, you should discuss not being pregnant again because obviously this was an inducer. If you look at diagnostic criteria, it's 1 month pre and 5 months post is the window in which you would be able to diagnose. I think that's a really important part that would be dictated in a test question that might give you some pause. Don't, if the cardiomyopathy is found a year after their pregnancy, don't fall for the peripartum cardiomyopathy diagnosis here because it doesn't fit the diagnostic criteria. Obviously, ejection fraction, that's less than normal, in this case, less than 45%. And then the left ventricular end diastolic dimension is 2.7 centimeters per millimeter square, or per meter square. Epidemiology and etiology, it's 1 in 4,000 women. Proposed mechanisms are inflammatory cytokines. So that's another mechanistic test question that might come up with peripartum cardiomyopathy. So they'll clearly present a peripartum cardiomyopathy based on these criteria, and then they might ask for the pathophysiology for this. And then finally, if you look at just cardiomyopathies in general, from a prognostic standpoint, etiology has a lot to do with this. And so You have to look at this right before you go into the test. Really, the main point here is the chemo-related or toxic-related cardiomyopathies have the highest mortality from time to diagnosis, and you need to be very aggressive about these. And idiopathic cardiomyopathies are a little bit better than ischemic. The issue with ischemic is that most of the ischemics don't make it to have a long-lasting cardiomyopathy, and they die suddenly as their initial event. So be very aggressive about looking into these types of disease processes in your patients, and I'll stop there.